Chapter 8 On Rescuing Jews and Others. One balmy winter morning, I took myself on a tour of homes in Los Angeles' Pacific Palisades, cruising along palm-lined streets called Napoli Drive, Amalfi Drive, Monaco Drive, and other names evoking the opposite side of the planet. I was the only tourist. The cartoonish palm trees among the European names reinforced my irrational fear of Los Angeles, a city that lacks so many of the things I was raised to consider normal, like seasons or aging or people who reserve the word historic for events that occurred prior to 1982. It is a place without markers of mortality, which made my tour particularly complicated. Instead of driving by the homes of the Kardashians, I was looking to solve the mystery of a group of people saved from the Holocaust by an American named Varian Fry. Between 1940 and 1941, working out of a hotel room and later a small office in the French port city of Marseille, Varian Fry rescued hundreds of artists, writers, musicians, composers, scientists, philosophers, intellectuals, and their families from the Nazis, taking enormous personal risks to bring them to the United States. Fry was one of only a few American righteous Gentiles, a man who voluntarily risked everything to save others, with no personal connection to those he saved. At the age of 32, Fry had volunteered to go to France on behalf of the Emergency Rescue Committee, an ad hoc group of American intellectuals formed in 1940 for the purpose of distributing emergency American visas to endangered European artists and thinkers. The U.S. Department of State, which initially supported the committee's mission, slowly turned against it in favor of its supposed allies in the unoccupied pro-Nazi French government, to the point of arranging for Fry's arrest and expulsion from France in 1941. During Fry's 13 months in Marseille, he managed to rescue roughly 2,000 people, including a hand-picked list of the brightest stars of European culture: Hannah Arendt, Marcel Duchamp, Marc Chagall, Max Ernst, Claude Lévi-Strauss, and André Breton, to name a few. Until recently, I had never heard of Fry, even though it is arguably because of him and because of his equally brave colleagues, including several other non-Jewish Americans, that these artists and intellectuals not only survived but reshaped the culture of America. But now I was driving through Los Angeles to see the former homes of some of these rescued luminaries and to meet a filmmaker who is one of the few living Americans who has heard of Varian Fry. We pay tribute to the righteous in order to ignore them. There have been no high-caliber books written about the righteous, no rigorous critical studies of what made these people do what they did. This is what I was told by Pierre Sauvage, the filmmaker who has spent much of the past two decades working on a documentary about Varian Fry. Bearded and bespectacled in a red polo shirt, Sauvage is convinced that the stories of Holocaust rescuers like Fry should be not merely inspirational but instructional, that by studying these exceptional people, we can learn to be more like them. It's a surprisingly lonely point of view. In 1984, Sauvage helped organize an international conference on the righteous, chaired by Elie Wiesel. "We brought all these righteous Gentiles to Washington," Sauvage recalled. "In the breaks between sessions, the righteous Gentiles were standing around being ignored by the scholars. No one spoke to them. No one engaged them. How can scholars not be fascinated by these people?" Sauvage is the director and proprietor of the Varian Fry Institute, a nonprofit archive of Fryana, as he calls it. On a warm winter morning in Los Angeles, he welcomed me to the Institute, which turned out to be a small office with floor-to-ceiling shelves of binders that revealed an obsession bordering on mania. Sauvage's collection of Fryana included everything from copies of Fry's letters to textbooks Fry wrote for a public affairs think tank to a poem Fry composed in French not long before his death. But most of the Fryana was stored on computers, containing video files of what was easily several months of Sauvage's filmed interviews with nearly every person who ever worked with, talked to, knew of, or breathed near Varian Fry. Sauvage's fascination with rescuers comes in part because he owes his life to them. He was born in 1944 in Le Chambon, France, a Huguenot village in the south-central part of the country in which the entire town, following the leadership of its Protestant clergy, formed a silent conspiracy of goodness, as Sauvage has called it, to shelter Jews from the Nazis. Sauvage's parents were among the thousands of Jews hidden by the righteous of Le Chambon. His 1989 film, Weapons of the Spirit, is a documentary about Le Chambon. It has become an educational staple that I watched in my high school French class. Sauvage's parents went to Le Chambon, he later discovered, after being rejected for rescue by Varian Fry. Fry was honored by Israel's Yad Vashem Holocaust Museum in 1997, 30 years after his death, as one of the righteous among the nations. There is also a street named after him in his hometown of Ridgewood, New Jersey, not far from where I live, as well as another street named after him in Berlin. But to Sauvage, this kind of recognition is meaningless when we make no attempt to learn what motivated him. Many years ago, in New York, I read about a guy who had fallen onto the subway tracks, and another man had jumped down to rescue him, Sauvage told me. When he was asked why he did it, he said, "What else could I do? There was a train coming." For most people, that would be the reason not to do it, but this man's response was automatic. Fiction and drama have given us a distorted sense of how rescuers think. Writers need a narrative arc, so they show these people wrestling with themselves, agonizing over what to do. But rescuers actually don't hesitate or agonize. They immediately recognize what the situation calls for. When they say that what they did was no big deal, we think they are being modest. They aren't. They genuinely experienced it as no big deal. From his research in Le Chambon, Sauvage developed his own theory about the righteous, that they are happy, secure people with a profound awareness of who they are. "I've never met an unhappy rescuer," he claimed. "These are people who are rooted in a clear sense of identity, who they are, what they love, what they hate, what they value. That gives them a footing to assess a situation." He described the inspiration the people of Le Chambon drew from their Protestant history and faith. Then he began showing me video footage of his interviews with Fry's colleagues, several exceedingly intelligent, colorful, and sincere Americans. All of them did indeed seem like happy people, with a deep sense of who they were. The only person missing from his footage is Varian Fry. I've long been uncomfortable with stories of Holocaust rescue, not least because of the painful fact that they are statistically insignificant, as are, for that matter, stories of Holocaust survival. But for me, the unease of these stories runs deeper. When I was 23 and just beginning my doctoral work in Yiddish, I barely understood the world I was entering. It was so distant from American culture, where even stories of the Holocaust are expected somehow to have happy endings. In Holocaust literature written in Yiddish, the language of the culture that was successfully destroyed, one doesn't find many musings on the kindness of strangers, because there actually wasn't much of that. Instead, one finds the overwhelming reality of the unavenged murder of innocents, along with cries of anguish, rage, and yes, vengeance. Far more palatable to American audiences are stories of Christian rescuers, because while they have the imprimatur of true stories, they also conveniently follow the familiar arc of fiction, inserting heroes into a reality almost entirely populated by villains and victims. But unlike the humble peasants of Le Chambon, Varian Fry felt oddly familiar to me, not just because he was young and American, but because he was very much the kind of young American I know best. Like me, he grew up in a commuter suburb in northern New Jersey. He graduated from Harvard in 1931, 68 years before I did. In photographs, he looks a lot like the guys with whom I went to college, thin, awkward, but handsome in a dorky way, his then stylish glasses and carefully knotted ties, a failed but endearing attempt at coolness. His personal letters, which I read in Columbia University's rare book room, are well-written and irreverent in a tone I recognize from my college friends, full of witty references to nerdy things ranging from the Aeneid. I was surprised to find so many more had joined us, ready for exile, to Gilbert and Sullivan. I am never disappointed in them, the rescued artists. What, never? Well, hardly ever. If he hadn't been dead for more than 50 years, I might have dated him. What felt creepily familiar about him, too, were his motivations. Unlike Le Chambon's pious French peasants who spoke of living lives worthy of Christ, Varian Fry went to France with a far more secular goal: to save Western civilization. The Emergency Rescue Committee that Fry worked for in France had evolved from an activist organization called the American Friends of German Freedom, a group of prominent American intellectuals from many fields. The Emergency Rescue Committee was formed after France fell to the Nazis, out of the fear that European culture itself was about to be lost forever. American writers, curators, and scholars took great pains to compile an A-list of great brains in need of rescue. It did not appear to occur to anyone at that time, as premier American minds argued over which premier European minds to include on the list, that there was a sort of eugenics to this anti-Nazi exercise as well, though later it would very much occur to Varian Fry. But when Fry volunteered, it was precisely the mission's elitist nature that excited him. In the introduction to his memoir, titled Surrender on Demand, Fry admitted it was one of his main reasons for going to France. Among the refugees who were caught in France were many writers and artists whose work I had enjoyed. Novelists like Franz Werfel and Leon Feuchtfanger, painters like Marc Chagall and Max Ernst, sculptors like Jacques Lipschitz, he wrote. For some of these men, although I knew them only through their work, I had a deep love. And to them all, I owed a heavy debt of gratitude for the pleasure they had given me. Now that they were in danger, I felt obligated to help them if I could, just as they, without knowing it, had often helped me. Yet the part of Fry's story that I found most unsettling was that this debt of gratitude turned out to be less than mutual. The mystery of why so few people today have heard of Varian Fry, despite his Americanness, his youth, his good looks, his Harvard degree, and the fact that the people he rescued were the guiding lights of Western civilization, seems linked to a peculiar lack of gratefulness among the many famous people whose lives he saved. The stories about how most of these rescued celebrities later avoided or ignored him are numerous and detailed. One of the more glaring examples is Hannah Arendt. Arendt, her mother, and her then-husband were on Fry's lists. As it happened, Arendt and her family left France after Fry's expulsion, saved by the Emergency Rescue Committee's remaining French staffers before the committee itself was shut down by the Vichy police. Yet, despite spending a lifetime writing about the philosophical implications of fascism, Arendt never once acknowledged in a single public word that she owed her life to Fry's committee, nor, it appears, in a private one, even when presented with the opportunity. In a collection of letters between Arendt and her fellow public intellectual, Mary McCarthy, McCarthy told Arendt about her experience meeting Varian Fry at a friend's home in 1952, describing him as a perfect madman, and elaborating on that insult in ways both inaccurate and cruel. Arendt replied to McCarthy's letter but said absolutely nothing in response to the ad hominem attack on the person whose organization had saved her life. Even if Arendt didn't know who Fry was, which would be difficult to imagine given his immense renown among refugees in Marseille, where Arendt lived while waiting to emigrate to the United States, it is nonetheless remarkable that her Holocaust-related writings, many dealing directly with righteous Gentiles, never mentioned that she was among the rescued. Sauvage, who deeply admires Arendt, appeared truly pained when he shared this detail with me. In one of her letters, Arendt says that a writer is his life, he said, in the tone of a confessional. How can you spend your whole life without acknowledging this part of your life? Not one word about Fry, or about the attempt to save a culture of which one were a part? It was, indeed, very odd. Because of the people Fry saved, New York became the international center of the post-war art world. Because of the people Fry saved, American universities became the premier research institutions on Earth. Because of the people Fry saved, Hollywood was reconfigured into global hegemony. Varian Fry, essentially, saved not only thousands of people, but the culture of Europe. Weren't we supposed to have seen this movie already? I asked Sauvage, who had been involved in Fry's mission, and he ticked off the various American players who had worked with Fry in France. Every one of them had already died, and Sauvage was the only one who had filmed interviews with them. So I decided to explore the only evidence left, in the hopes of unraveling the mystery of Fry's heroic actions, as well as the darker mystery of why the culture he saved has largely forgotten him. The answers were far more disturbing than I could possibly have imagined. In 1935, Varian Fry was 27 years old, spending a month in Berlin as the editor of the American magazine The Living Age, when he witnessed how a modern, civilized country executes a pogrom. Near the end of his trip, stormtroopers engineered a riot that happened to take place right outside his hotel. Hearing shouting in the streets from inside the lobby, he stepped out onto the Kurfürstendamm, which at that time was among the city's most expensive and fashionable streets. I found a large crowd lined up on both sides of the street, forcing each car which came by to run the gauntlet, stopping all cars in which Jewish-looking men or women were riding and dragging out the Jews and beating them up. He reported by phone for the Associated Press. I saw one man brutally kicked and spat upon as he lay on the sidewalk, a woman bleeding, a man whose head was covered with blood. All along the Kfürstendamm, the crowd raised the shout Jude whenever anyone sighted or thought he'd sighted a Jew. The cry sent the crowd converging on the poor victim who was asked for his identification papers. If he could not prove himself a good Aryan, he was insulted, spat upon, roughly handled, and sometimes knocked down, kicked, and beaten. Since gore is now routinely depicted in the news, I found it difficult to appreciate the level of brutality Fry was describing when I first read this article in the archives of the New York Times, in which it ran on July 17, 1935. It turned out that Fry, or maybe his editors, had understated the violence for the benefit of delicate New York readers who perhaps preferred a minimum of blood with their morning coffee. Several of those Fry saw being beaten had died of their wounds by the following day. But what astonished Fry was less the raw cruelty than the organized spectacle of it. At times, he reported, a chant would be raised, "The best Jew is a dead Jew," precisely like a Christian liturgy, with the leader speaking the lines first and the crowd chanting them over and over again, line for line, after he had finished. Everywhere the people were in a holiday mood. In fact, one German youth said to me, "This is a holiday for us." Old men and young men, boys, stormtroopers, police, young girls of the domestic servant type, well-bred women, some even in the 40s and over, all seemed to be having a good time. The parallels with Christianity that Fry reported for the Associated Press and the Times, the liturgical chanting, the sense of a holiday, were not the only ones to come up during his stay in Berlin. Mary Jane Gold, one of Fry's co-rescuers, wrote in her memoir of Fry telling her of another incident he witnessed in 1935 Berlin that later motivated him to return to Europe. At a cafe, Varian watched a pair of stormtroopers approach the table of a Jewish-looking individual, Gold recalled. When the poor man reached nervously for his beer, with a quick thrust of his knife, one of the stormtroopers pinned the man's hand to the wooden table. The victim let out a cry and bent over in pain, unable to move. I think the mental image of that hand nailed to the table beside the beer mug had something to do with Fry's decision to go. I read this story and could not help but notice what the hyper-literate Fry had surely noticed himself. He'd witnessed a crucifixion. It was, of course, too gory a tale for the New York Times. Visiting the Nazis' foreign press office the day after the pogrom, Fry was granted an interview with Ernst Hofstengel, the Nazis' chief foreign press officer. Hofstengel was delighted to speak with Fry because he and Fry had much in common. Like Fry, Hofstengel was an American, and like Fry, he was a Harvard alumnus. Also like Fry, he was passionate about the creative arts. Hofstengel was a talented pianist and composer, and in his younger days, he had written several popular fight songs for the Harvard football team. In his current job, he had used his talents again, adapting his Harvard fight songs into anthems for the Hitler Youth. Hofstengel cheerily informed Fry that there were two groups within the Nazi party, a moderate wing that wanted to expel the Jews and a radical wing, led by Adolf Hitler, that wanted to murder them. Fry's report of this conversation also appeared in the New York Times. In 1942, in an article for the New Republic titled "The Massacre of the Jews," Fry admitted that when Hofstengel told me in his cultured Harvard accent that the radicals among Nazi party leaders intended to solve the Jewish problem by the physical extermination of the Jews, I only half believed him. I learned better in November 1938. The cultured Harvard accent of this Nazi leader haunted Varian Fry. But what haunted me were the Harvard fight songs. It would take me much longer to fully understand their implications. In 1940, what American intellectuals viewed as an emergency finally arose. In June of that year, the Germans took over the northern half of France. With the June 14th fall of Paris, which had become a capital for refugee intellectuals, thousands who had fled Germany suddenly found themselves in what Fry would later call the greatest man-trap in history. These refugees fled Paris, as did much of the city's population, for France's southern unoccupied half, where the French government then herded any German nationals they could find, most of whom were Jews or political refugees, into French-run concentration camps, ostensibly to prevent German espionage. When France surrendered to Germany on June 25th, the Nazis established a puppet government based in the southern city of Vichy in exchange for complete collaboration with the Nazis. In Article 19 of the armistice terms, the Vichy government agreed to surrender on demand all Germans named by the German government in France. That is, anyone who was on the Gestapo's list, a list that would quickly expand beyond German Jews and anti-Nazi activists to include just about anyone the Nazis didn't like, including many well-known degenerate artists. The window for escape from Europe was closing, but the refugees had nowhere to go. Few countries wanted them, even though they were some of the premier artistic, scientific, and intellectual minds of the world. As Herbert Pell, then the U.S. envoy to Portugal, put it, "There is a fire sale on brains here, and we are not taking full advantage of it." The Emergency Rescue Committee was created in New York the day after the French surrender at a pre-scheduled benefit event for the American Friends of German Freedom to provide emergency visas for prominent refugees and to escort them out of France. Ingrid Warburg, niece of the German-Jewish financier Felix Warburg and a well-known patron of the arts, took the reins in developing lists of endangered European artists as well as in raising money for the cause, mainly, as she told Sauvage decades later, from Jewish donors. Curators at the Museum of Modern Art assembled lists of artists thought to be most in danger. The Nobel Prize-winning German novelist Thomas Mann, teaching at Princeton, provided lists of similarly endangered German-language writers. The leaders of various universities compiled their own wish lists of scholars, thinkers, and scientists. The committee proposed many people for the job of traveling to the unoccupied zone and distributing visas to those on the genius lists, but anyone qualified to do it, those with personal connections to the intellectuals to be rescued, or those who had been refugees themselves, would, by definition, also be in danger. When no one else stepped up, the committee reluctantly said yes to a 32-year-old volunteer, a nobody who had no relevant experience and no qualifications for the job. Varian Fry. But who was he? This is a question that confused me, and it seems to have confused Fry, too. One could call him a journalist, but that descriptor would be only somewhat true. He worked for several American magazines, but he never held any such job for more than a year or two, barely ever worked as a reporter, and abandoned journalism entirely before he turned 40. One could call him an intellectual, but that also doesn't quite fit, as the term is usually reserved for academics, pundits, or prolific critics, and Fry was none of these. His teaching was limited to high school, and the vast majority of the writing he would publish in his life was for school textbooks or Coca-Cola Company reports. One could call him a lover of the arts, and that is surely true, but it hardly counts as a profession or an identity, and he was not a patron of the arts, except in the sense that he saved artists' lives. One could call him a WASP blue blood, but that isn't accurate either. While he was certainly a WASP, he had grown up in a comfortable but not terribly wealthy family, with no pedigree to speak of, and no fortune to finance his whims. Pierre Sauvage insists that rescuers almost uniformly had a role model that influenced them, because if one doesn't have an image of how one should behave in a similar situation, one simply doesn't know what's possible. If Fry had any such person in his life, it was his grandfather, a man who worked for the Orphan Trains, a children's aid society operation that collected abandoned children from city streets and exported them to foster homes in the American West. Fry's second wife, Annette, who divorced him 2 weeks before his unexpected death in 1967, claimed that Fry was very much inspired by his grandfather's work. She herself was clearly inspired by it. She published a children's book about the Orphan Trains 30 years after Fry died. But as I picked my way through Fry's vast personal papers at Columbia University, to which Annette had donated them after his death, I found no mention of this wonderful grandfather who supposedly inspired the greatest act of Fry's life. Andy Marino, who wrote one of the two biographies of Fry published in the past 25 years, points to Fry's experience being bullied at the prestigious Hotchkiss boarding school as a defining moment for him. Fry's hazing there, which included being forced to traverse a room hand over hand, hanging from a scalding steam pipe across the ceiling, supposedly made him drop out, but this life-changing instance of teenage torment isn't something I could find Fry ever mentioning either. And if being bullied in school motivates people toward heroism, there ought to be a whole lot more heroes in the world. And all of Fry's supposed marginalization did not prevent him from graduating from Harvard, where he not only earned a degree in classics, but also co-founded a nationally important literary journal, Hound and Horn, with Lincoln Kirstein, who later co-founded the New York City Ballet and was an important member of the planning committee for Lincoln Center. The more I learned about Fry, the less I believed that he was a noble loner isolated by his principles. His personal correspondence covers multiple microfilm reels, featuring many, many people. For an outcast, he sure seemed to have a lot of friends. After college, Fry moved to New York, where he had a job writing Reader's Digest-style books on current events for a publisher and think tank called the Foreign Press Association, before taking the position at the Living Age. At 23, in 1931, he married 31-year-old Eileen Hughes, an editor at The Atlantic. Their marriage was childless and, by all accounts, challenging. It became even more difficult when Fry left for France in August of 1940, planning to bike around Provence and birdwatch while delivering visas to the people on the Emergency Rescue Committee's lists. He expected the job to be completed in 4 weeks. As it happened, he stayed for more than a year. In our current century, it is difficult to appreciate the vast renown of many of the people on Varian Fry's lists, only a few of whom are still household names. Today, for instance, few readers outside of Germany have heard of the German-Jewish novelist Leon Feuchtwanger, but by 1940 he was the most widely read German-language writer in the world, and in translation, one of the most widely read writers in the world, period. A fact especially noteworthy because nearly all of his pre-1940 novels deal with explicitly Jewish themes. The book that catapulted him to fame was Jew Zeus, published in the United States as Power, a fictionalized biography of Josef Zeus Oppenheimer, a Jewish financier for Prussian royalty in the 18th century. Oppenheimer's sentencing on fraudulent anti-Semitic charges included hanging and gibbeting, or the public display of his hanged corpse in a suspended, human-sized birdcage for 6 years. Refusing a last-minute conversion that would have averted his death sentence, Oppenheimer died Al Kiddush Hashem, in sanctification of God's name, reciting the Shema, Judaism's central statement of faith in one God. Oppenheimer's story had been fictionalized before and was later the subject of a Nazi film, but Feuchtwanger's 1925 version, in which Oppenheimer is a complex figure forced to choose between power and dignity, became an international bestseller. When Feuchtwanger's close friend Sinclair Lewis won the 1930 Nobel Prize for Literature, Lewis declared in his acceptance speech that Feuchtwanger should have received the prize instead. Having never heard of Feuchtwanger before, I read The Oppermanns, one of the few contemporary novels he ever wrote. Set in 1932 and 1933, The Oppermanns is the story of four Jewish siblings in Berlin, scions to a successful furniture business founded by their grandfather in the 19th century. As the Nazi influence grows, each family member's sense of self-worth is degraded or destroyed in a dramatic way. From the elder brother, who is forced to surrender the family's firm to a competitor, to the teenage son, who resorts to suicide to end his humiliation at the hands of his high school teacher, to a younger brother who signs a petition and ends up in a concentration camp where he is tortured into madness. Ultimately, the close-knit family is scattered across the world as they flee the country they had always considered home. The novel's events are described as taking place at the end of 14 years of anti-Semitic incitement in Germany, tracing back to Germany's devastating defeat in the First World War. The book is full of references to Judaism, including quotations from the Talmud, yet Feuchtwanger's writing is conventional, engaging, but not artistic. Today, the story feels familiar, even trite, until one remembers that it was first published in German in November of 1933. In my own novels, I often struggle with the desire to write current events into fiction. Usually I chicken out, too nervous about branding myself politically or making statements I might later regret. If this is how a writer feels in peacetime, in the freest of societies, then the courage required to write a novel like Feuchtwanger's when he did is almost unfathomable. I saw a hint of the scope of that courage in the author's note that appears on the book's first page. After the type of this volume has already been set, a family by the name of Oppermann advised the publisher that Oppermann is a strictly Christian name and that they would therefore like to have it avoided that bearers of the name Oppermann be branded before the general public as belonging to a Jewish family. In view of the existing circumstances, the publisher readily understands this attitude on the part of the Oppermann family and herewith advises the readers of this novel of the facts which the Oppermann family wishes to have readily understood. Reading the delicate wording of this author's note is like watching someone balance on a tightrope over a bonfire. Feuchtwanger had spent 1932 in America on a lecture tour. When Hitler came to power, his house in Berlin was confiscated, and he was among the first public figures to be stripped of his German citizenship. With his wife, Martha, he went to France, and by 1940 he had landed in a French concentration camp. A photograph of him behind barbed wire moved one of his readers, Eleanor Roosevelt, to offer her support to the Emergency Rescue Committee. Support she would withdraw once the State Department began to turn against the committee's work. By the time Fry arrived in France, Feuchtwanger had already escaped from the camp with the help of the American vice consul in Marseille, Hiram Bingham IV, a righteous Gentile from a long line of traveling truth seekers. Hiram's the first and second introduced Christianity to Hawaii. Hiram III discovered the ruins of Machu Picchu. Bingham had nabbed Feuchtwanger while prisoners were bathing in a river and then disguised him in women's clothes for the trip to Marseille. Fry found him and Martha hiding in Bingham's house. Feuchtwanger was so famous that he was terrified of being recognized on the street. The internationally acclaimed and similarly best-selling Austrian Jewish novelist Franz Werfel was even more passionate in warning his readers about the totalitarian menace. His best-known book, The 40 Days of Moussa Dagh, has rightly become an enduring classic. As an anti-Nazi novel, it was more coy than the Oppermanns, hiding behind a historical story about the persecution and murder of Armenians by the Ottoman Turks. In his own author's note, Werfel goes out of his way to maintain the charade, declaring, "This book was conceived in March of 1929 in the course of a stay in Damascus that inspired him to write about this incomprehensible destiny of the Armenian nation." It was published in 1933 and became a phenomenon around the world. Werfel lost his citizenship when Germany annexed Austria in 1938, and like Feuchtwanger, he fled to France. For all of Werfel's international fame, he became even better known through his wife, Alma, who was notorious among Europe's creative elite. A non-Jew with family connections high in the pre-Nazi Austrian government and a romantic attraction to fame, Alma Schindler had already broken the heart of the Austrian painter Gustav Klimt before she turned 18. From that humble beginning, she moved on to Jewish artists, embarking on a lifetime of screwing over brilliant Jewish men. She dumped Klimt for the prominent Austrian Jewish composer Alexander Zemlinsky, whom she subsequently dumped to marry the rather more prominent Austrian Jewish composer Gustav Mahler. Mahler, besotted, dedicated the movements of various symphonies to her. Her later control over Mahler's legacy became so intense and distorting that the term the Alma problem is now a concept in musicology. Alma dumped Mahler in 1910 to marry one of her few non-Jewish lovers, the Bauhaus architect Walter Gropius, an experience that exiled Mahler to Freud's couch and, 5 months later, an untimely death. To no one's surprise, Gropius failed to meet Alma's standards, and she dumped him for the artist Oskar Kokoschka, also later saved by Fry's mission, whom she subsequently dumped because, as she told a friend, "Oscar is not a genius, and I only marry geniuses." Being no genius, Kokoschka took this even harder than Mahler. He coped by custom ordering a nude, life-size Alma mannequin, accurate down to the breasts and genitals, which he dressed in haute couture and lived with for over a year, dining with it in restaurants and sitting beside it at the opera. He then threw a party during which he and his friends smashed wine bottles over the mannequin's head until it was destroyed. Alma, meanwhile, had already moved on to genius husband number three, Franz Werfel, to whom she wasn't faithful either, but who at least earned her a place on the lists of the Emergency Rescue Committee. It was at his first meeting with the Werfels that Varian Fry would realize, as he put it in a letter to his wife, "the shock of my own inadequacy." That is, just how over his head he actually was in Marseille. They met in the hotel where the Werfels were staying, as Fry mentions in his memoir, under the name Mr. and Mrs. Gustav Mahler. When I read this line, I laughed out loud. The dark comedy routine between the famous and the starstruck had only just begun. Werfel looked exactly like his photographs, Fry wrote, large, dumpy, and pallid, like a half-filled sack of flour. The half-filled sack of flour was completing a novel, Song of Bernadette, the sale of movie rights to which would later buy him a house in Beverly Hills. Meanwhile, he and Alma were hiding from death, in a bathrobe and slippers, because really, why bother getting dressed for the person offering to save your life? He explained to Fry the precise nature of the problem. Thanks to the Emergency Rescue Committee, the Werfels had obtained their American visas at the U.S. consulate in Marseille, but leaving Vichy France actually required two visas, one for the destination country and the other an exit visa from the French government. The French government would not issue exit visas to persons whom it had promised to surrender on demand to the Gestapo. In fact, applying for one was among the more efficient ways to alert the Gestapo to one's presence in Marseille. Alma knew of people who had left France without exit visas by crossing into Spain over the Pyrenees, but no one knew what happened to them once they arrived in fascist Spain. Should the Verifuls apply for exit visas and hope for the best, or should they risk leaving the country illegally, and if so, how was this half-filled sack of flour going to climb over a mountain range? "You must try to save us, Mr. Fry," Franz Verifull pleaded in English, according to Fry's memoir. "Oh, yeah, you must save us," Alma said casually and poured them more wine. Reading this, I could almost hear Alma's languid voice, the voice of a jaded celebrity accustomed to using other people as means to ends. It seemed clear to me, if not immediately to Fry, that the Verifuls in their pajamas had instantly recognized the odd young American as their latest hired help. Unfortunately, Fry had no idea how to help them. After his date with the Verifuls, Fry met Frank Bon, an American who had been sent by the American Federation of Labor to rescue refugees who were labor activists. Bon already knew the drill. He explained to Fry that he didn't need to go out looking for the people on his lists. Word would spread quickly that an American had arrived with dollars and visas, and they would come to him. Bon also explained that the only way to get these refugees out of France was through illegal means. Fry's would be an underground operation, with the cover story that it was a humanitarian mission to provide refugees with money while they waited for legal visas, money they desperately needed, as most had had no income source for months. Fry set up shop at the Hotel Splendide and referred to his office by the abbreviated name AmaRescue, or in French, Centre Américain de Secours. The visa game had complicated rules. The U.S. State Department had authorized special emergency visas, but the American consulate in Marseille, eager to please its allies and the Vichy government, took its time issuing them. Even refugees who were able to obtain French exit visas often found that by the time they did so, their American visas had expired. Sometimes a third transit visa was also required for travel through Spain and Portugal to Lisbon, from where New York sailings departed. Many stateless refugees could not even obtain the necessary papers for travel within France. Refugees with no papers at all, or whose names were well known, true of many on Fry's lists, needed false passports, which Fry obtained from a disgruntled former Czech consul. One of the first refugees who met Fry helpfully provided him with a map of the French-Spanish border town of Sebel, where refugees could pass border patrols by crawling behind a cemetery wall. Fry hid the map behind the mirror in his room at the Splendide. Within days, he looked outside his hotel room window and saw long lines of terrified refugees all waiting for him. The hotel concierge was becoming irate. Fry decided to hire a staff, and these were the dead people whom I was able to meet in Los Angeles, courtesy of the many hours of filmed interviews conducted by Pierre Sauvage. Fry's right-hand man was Albert Otto Hirschmann, a young German Jew who had come to France to study before the war and then enlisted in the French army, where he invented an identity for himself as a Philadelphia-born Frenchman named Albert Armand. With the army's defeat, he had become a specialist in all things illegal, making friends with Marseille's gangsters and becoming Fry's chief link to Marseille's underworld, supplying bogus passports and fenced cash. "My advantage," he told Sauvage, "was that I was not easily scared." To manage the crowds at the door, Fry hired Charlie Fawcett, a wrestler from the American Volunteer Ambulance Corps. Fawcett recalled a Vichy policeman who tried to deter refugees from entering Fry's offices. Fawcett's professional wrestling hold on the man's head ended his interference. Fawcett also found ingenious ways to conceal messages between Marseille and New York. Since the Vichy police censored all telegrams and mail, important information about the mission had to be sent to New York with refugee couriers. In condoms inserted into toothpaste tubes, for example. Fawcett found a way to hide messages in a trumpet and even learned to play a few tunes that didn't require the third valve where the messages were hidden in case border guards got suspicious. It worked. "No one takes you seriously when you're holding a trumpet," Fawcett said with a laugh. Working hard at not being taken seriously, he was once asked by a refugee if he were a bachelor. "When I said I was, she said she had two Jewish women for me to marry to get them out of France." He remembered. "In the end, I married six of them." Another essential employee was Miriam Davenport, a Smith College graduate from a poor family in Iowa who had been studying art on scholarship in Paris when the Nazis took over. "In France, I suddenly realized that I had lost my future," Davenport told Sauvage years later. She came to Fry only because she had fled to Marseille with her next-door neighbor, Walter Mehring, a German poet who was on Fry's lists. Noticing her knowledge of art, Fry hired her to process the steady stream of refugees who came through his door, to decide who was famous, who was talented, and who was really in danger. "I'm terrible with names," she said, "but at that time I remembered every client's name, because all these people had were their names." When asked why she took the job, Davenport recalled her Christian upbringing. "The Book of Ruth was read to me as a fairy tale," she told Sauvage. "I felt very strongly that these people were my people, and that I had to do something about it." The thing she did about it was to approach Mary Jane Gold, a young WASP heiress from Illinois whom she had met during the flight from Paris, for funding to expand Fry's A-list to include a B-list. Gold, who had already donated her private plane to the French Resistance, provided more than cash. When four refugees on Fry's list were imprisoned in the Vernet concentration camp, Fry suggested that Gold use feminine wiles to persuade the camp's commandant to release them. Gold, who at 31 had already had a dozen years' worth of sexual adventures across Europe, was game. When she arrived at the camp, she saw guards filling in graves before she met the commandant, and gave him the names of the prisoners she wanted freed. "I tried to be something between sexy and ladylike," she said. "It worked." He asked her out to dinner that night, and their agreement was as tacit as it was clear. But that evening, she waited in the restaurant for hours. The commandant had stood her up. The following day, she went back to the camp. I asked him, "What about our date?" He told me, "Mademoiselle, I assure you I would have rather had dinner with you, but I had to dine with the Gestapo. Your friends will be on the train at noon, on my honor." It killed me that he had a sense of honor. One of the strangest things about watching Sauvage's interviews with these brave people is, as Sauvage had told me, how happy they appear. Articulate, warm, witty, and brilliant, they are impossible to dislike. Their age, most were in their 80s when Sauvage interviewed them, makes their happiness seem almost a part of them, a defining feature of who they are, as Sauvage would have it. But as I watch them recall their experiences, often laughing at their antics from their youthful days, I couldn't help but feel as though something were missing. Perhaps it was merely the filter of an interview, or the polite reserve of a generation taught to hide emotions. But as they spoke of a time that was surely full of impossible choices, the horror of imminent arrest and the devastating reality of being forced to turn away many thousands of people and leave them to their deaths, these genuine heroes gave no sign on screen that they had been involved in something that didn't have an entirely happy ending. Instead, they seemed to see the whole thing as a fun adventure, free from any anger or regret. But then I began to wonder if I were the one being fooled. "We were misfits," Miriam Davenport said of Fry's team. "We didn't fit the pattern of human behavior, of staying out of trouble and keeping your mouth shut." The biggest misfit was Fry himself. Wanting to project an air of authority, he dressed in dapper pinstriped suits each day, with a pressed handkerchief in his pocket and a flower in his lapel, shaking refugees' hands with supreme confidence and sending them off with a "see you in New York." It was a stage act of the breezy American, at a time when Fry's organization was still so under-resourced that he and his staffers, unable to afford their own office space, were holding meetings in the bathroom of his hotel room with the faucets running to avoid being overheard by Vichy spies. Fry's confident persona with his refugee clients was incongruous, both in war-torn Marseille and with the difficult personality his closest associates knew. "One of the secrets of his success," Gold told Sauvage, "was that he was an ornery cuss. As I was starting to realize, Fry had trouble getting along with anyone." His need to micromanage the mission led Fry to escort the Werfels over the Pyrenees himself. He also took three other refugees. Heinrich Mann, a phenomenally popular anti-Nazi novelist and brother of Thomas Mann. Heinrich Mann's wife, Nellie, and Thomas Mann's son, Golo, a renowned historian. The Feuchtwangers would follow shortly along the same route. To say the refugees were unprepared for the journey would be a massive understatement. Alma Werfel arrived at the train station with 17 pieces of luggage, all of which she insisted were essential. Some contained manuscripts of Mahler's symphonies, though most contained her clothes. For her stealth trek over the Pyrenees, she wore a bright white dress, which even the least attentive border guard scanning the horizon would be hard-pressed to miss. Heinrich Mann, unaccustomed to the name on his forged documents, had forgotten to relabel his clothes. Fry, gladly playing the part of hired help, picked Mann's monogram out of his hat for him. When they reached the border, Fry and Alma's luggage took a train through the mountains, while the refugees traversed them on foot. with the athletically challenged Werfel nearly being carried over the hills by Leon Ball, another American expatriate who worked for Fry. Along with the luggage, the refugees also ditched their old identification papers with Fry on the train. Their noble servant then had to torch them all in the train's bathroom. The paper burned with an acrid, choky smoke, Fry later wrote. And not daring to open the door, I had to get down on the floor for air. When the refugees met him at the Spanish border post many hours later, we almost fell into one another's arms as though we were old friends who had been separated for years and had met by accident in some strange city where none of us ever expected to be. That warm embrace, I was beginning to understand, was not quite what it seemed. Not everyone was so lucky. Fry's most famous failure was the literary critic Walter Benjamin. Fry had provided Benjamin with his American visa, as well as a forged passport and a personal escort over the Pyrenees. Unfortunately, the day in September 1940 that Benjamin arrived in Spain was the day Spain decided to close the frontier. Prior to that, refugees without French exit visas who slipped past French border patrols could present their Spanish transit visas to Spanish border guards a few miles down the hill without comment. Terrified of turning back, even more terrified of sneaking further into fascist Spain, and completely convinced that posterity would take note of the crucial manuscripts in his suitcase, Benjamin killed himself on the Spanish border. The suitcase and its manuscripts were discarded by a customs officer after his body was found. Back in Marseille, Fry had acquired an actual office, which the Vichy police soon raided. He decided that a refuge outside the city was necessary. With funding from Mary Jane Gold's fortune, he rented a large suburban house full of gilded mirrors and taxidermied animals. It was called Villa Herbel. Herbel became a haven for refugee surrealists, who passed the frigid winter of 1940 to 1941 there with Véry and Fry. Occupants included André Breton, poet and founding father of French surrealism, who decorated the premises with jars of live praying mantises, his wife Jacqueline Lame de Breton, a dancer and artist, their five-year-old daughter Aube, whom the surrealists already lauded as a brilliant painter, Wilfredo Lam, a French-Cuban painter who was Picasso's only protégé, Benjamin Perret, whom Fry described as the French poet whose verses sometimes read as though they had been copied down from the walls of public toilets, Victor Bronner, the one-eyed Romanian painter whose women and cats all had one eye, and many other writers and artists, nearly all of whom later became fixtures in the American art establishment. On Sundays, the Saint-Exupérys, Henri Matisse, André Masson, and André Malraux would stop by, staging impromptu exhibits and performances. Under rationing, they nearly starved. As Fry wrote to his father, if you want to get some idea of what it is like living in France now, drink postum with saccharin and no milk, eat stale bread without jam or butter, and treat yourself on rare occasions to a slice of an old horse. But when I read this letter, I could see that for Fry, the exotic austerity was clearly part of the fun. And it was a glamorous austerity indeed. The house came with a cook, a waitress, a laundress, a maid, a gardener, and even a barber who shaved the male occupants daily. And while there wasn't much food, there was somehow plenty of wine. The artists in residence played surrealist games, putting on exhibits by hanging their paintings from trees, making playing card decks featuring Baudelaire and Freud, and singing long into the night. It was the high point of Fry's life. Fry's delight in holing up with the stars of the European intellectual establishment did not go over well at home. The State Department made it clear that it would cooperate with its Vichy French allies in tracking Fry's illegal activities. The evil of the American government in discouraging desperate immigrants haunts many students of this period, including Sauvage. In fact, Sauvage believes that the reason Fry is so unknown is precisely because he reveals U.S. complicity in the Holocaust. We live on two myths, that we didn't know, and that we couldn't do anything even if we did know, Sauvage said to me as soon as I sat down in his office. This is the religion, and it isn't true. We knew plenty and could have done a lot. Véry and Fry was a hero, but he was also a maverick who flew in the face of American policy. He shouldn't be allowed to acquit everyone who wasn't with him. There is a painful and undeniable truth to this. When Fry's American passport expired, the American embassy refused to renew it, placing him in mortal danger. The Emergency Rescue Committee in New York, aware that Fry had run afoul of the State Department, also began calling for his immediate return. But Fry refused to leave. Fry's wife, Eileen, who stayed in New York and acted as his liaison to the Emergency Rescue Committee, had been begging him to return home for months. She also had her own ideas about Fry's mission. In one of her first letters, before Fry had settled himself in Marseille and disabused her of the common notion that France was full of orphans dying in the streets, she wrote, "I did not speak to you about bringing back a French child, which probably seems an absurd suggestion to you at the moment. And of course I don't want you to go around looking for one. I just mean that you must be sure to bring one back if you feel that is what you want to do with any special one." The idea of Fry bringing back a French child as a kind of souvenir for his childless wife does seem absurd compared to rescuing Europe's greatest minds, but in fact, Eileen's suggestion was not so different from what Fry was actually sent to France to do. To handpick the special ones among the refugees who had been deemed worth saving, and by necessity, to leave the rest behind to nearly inevitable murder. The inevitability of murder, of course, is the premise of all narratives of Holocaust rescue, and part of what makes me so uncomfortable with them. The assumption in such stories is that the open maw of death for Europe's Jews and dissidents was something like a natural disaster. These stories, in some sense, force us, people removed from that time by generations, to ask the wrong questions, the kind of questions that we might ask about a shipwreck or an epidemic. Someone has to die, this thinking goes, and the only remaining dilemma is who will get the last seat on the lifeboat or the last vaccine. But these questions fall short by assuming that the perpetrators were irrelevant. As long as we are questioning the choices that were made, shouldn't we be considering the possibility of the Holocaust not happening at all? If someone was in a position to choose whether to save person A or person B, shouldn't whole societies have been in the position to reject the notion of genocide altogether? Why didn't everyone become Denmark? The stories of rescuers that we find most satisfying, as Sauvage points out, are those in which rescuers agonize over what they are doing, wondering whom to save. There is a kind of Purian appeal in observing that agony at a distance, which explains the popularity of fictions like Sophie's Choice and fictionalizations like the movie version of Schindler's List. Sauvage is disturbed by this notion of the anguished rescuer because it assumes that people cannot possibly be as good as they actually are. But the unarticulated and more disturbing idea here is that rescuers like Fry do not actually call into question the premise that innocent people are doomed to be murdered. Instead, such stories simply reveal that the most righteous people available could do no more than provide for a tiny number of people the possibility of remaining alive. In this sense, rescuer stories are the opposite of inspirational. They are stories that make painfully clear everything that might have been. Sauvage is not merely dismissive of the elitism charge against Fry's mission. He is positively hostile to it. I think that devaluing rescuers who only do a little bit is a way for the person who does nothing to make himself feel less guilty, he told me. You judge a mission by what is accomplished, not by what it didn't accomplish. This is an odd position for Sauvage to take, given that his own parents, non-famous Jews who did not fit Fry's mission of rescuing celebrity intellectuals, were among the thousands of desperate people Fry had to turn down. In this sense, the survival of Sauvage himself, born in Le Chambon after his parents were lucky enough to find someone who said yes to saving their lives, is one of the things that Fry's committee didn't accomplish. More confusingly, Sauvage also seems to want us to judge America by what it didn't accomplish, while arguing that the exclusive nature of Fry's mission was exactly what made him want to accomplish it. When I challenged Sauvage on this, he defended Fry, along with his own theory of the righteous. Altruism is a bogus concept, he said. Most rescuers, according to Sauvage, derived great joy from what they did. Fry was meeting a deep need within himself. He was an intellectual and a lover of the arts. He was really helping the people he loved. It is certainly true that Fry was saving people who felt like family to him, as he put it in one of his many telegrams to Eileen, refusing to leave France. Could no more abandon my people here than my own children. Stop. Hundreds have come to depend on me for money, advice, comfort. Stop. Leaving now would be criminally irresponsible. Stop. In another telegram begging the committee for more time, he put his concerns more bluntly. Please make them realize we have undertaken immense tasks saving culture, Europe. Stop. We had hardly any money, Miriam Davenport said in one of Sauvage's interviews, describing how she felt when forced to make decisions about who was worth saving. It was one of her few moments on screen without a smile. Our money was specifically designated for people whose art had put them in danger. We were helping the people who were in danger because of what they believed. But what, I wondered, did these rescued people believe? In December of 1940, Vichy police turned up at Villa Herbel and arrested Varian Fry, along with several artists and colleagues. Fry managed to burn some address lists and forged passports in the bathroom, but an anti-Vichy doodle by Antoine Breton was sufficient to imprison the entire group in the Marseille harbor, on a steamship crammed with 600 prisoners. Fry threw a note for the American consul onto the pier, wrapped in a 10-franc bill. Receiving the message, the consul sent nothing more than a tray of sandwiches. Once the group was arbitrarily freed, 3 days later, Fry found himself tailed by 8 plainclothes cops. Fry continued sending refugees out of France, and the Vichy police began tapping his phone. They arrested several of his French colleagues, and their aggression toward the refugees worsened when Vichy passed its first anti-Jewish laws in 1941. Police ran dragnets in Marseille, arrested every foreign Jew they could find. One of those arrested was Marc Chagall. In high dudgeon, Fry contacted the police and yelled at them for arresting one of the world's greatest living artists. If the news of his arrest should leak out, the whole world would be shocked, Fry informed them. Half an hour later, Chagall was freed. The team rejoiced, but Mary Jane Gold spotted Fry wiping his glasses, muttering under his breath, "No, we should be able to save them all. Why just the world's greatest painter?" When I read Gold's account of this moment, I saw in it the very first evidence of a crack in Fry's facade. Before this point, he had seemed like one of the happy rescuers of Sauvage's theory, and then some, a cheerful servant of the famous. But now, something new was happening to Fry, or perhaps he was merely revealed for who he always was. A person blessed or cursed, with the ability to see what no one else could see. On August 29th, 1941, the Vichy police arrested Varian Fry on behalf of the U.S. government. As the police chief had explained to Fry a few weeks earlier, "You have caused my good friend, the Consul General of the United States, much annoyance. Your government and the committee you represent have both asked you to return to the United States without delay." He was warned then that he would be arrested if he did not leave the country on his own. Fry's wife had attempted to ensure her husband's safety by soliciting help from powerful people in America. The only tangible result was a letter from Eleanor Roosevelt. "I am sorry to say that there is nothing I can do for your husband. I think he will have to come home because he has done things which the government does not feel it can stand behind." Fry's entire staff escorted him to the Spanish border, along with the Vichy police. The Vichy government had thoughtfully provided him with an exit visa.